Testing, testing, testing. All right, that seems like it's working. All right, and then we'll get this going. Okay, welcome everyone. This is week 7 of Anatomy of the Fed, and these are the office hour sessions. And this is when we turn the program over to you guys for your questions. So we got about 8 people logged in right now, so go ahead and fire away. So Benjamin says, the Ben Bernanke said on 60 Minutes that he was 100% certain he could reverse course in 15 minutes. Can you explain how he can be so sure? Who would buy the Fed's treasuries and other assets if they wanted to unload them? How much of a potential loss would the Fed taxpayers have to eat? And what would the withdrawal do to the economy? He must have forgot to mention these things. He also said he is not printing money. Is he confused, or does he think he can fool all the people all the time? All right, that's a very cynical question, Benjamin. So, yeah, I don't know if you saw it, but in the article that I linked for this class that ran, I guess, maybe 2 Mondays ago, talking about, I forget what the main point of the article was, but yeah, I did reference this issue, and I said that when Bernanke said, so in that interview, in that 60 Minutes interview, one of the things he said, which you mentioned, Benjamin, is that he said, you know, there's this conception out, misconception out there that we're printing money. No, we're not. This quantity of money has not grown in any significant way since the crisis began. All right, so first of all, no matter how you interpret that, it's either misleading or an outright lie. And I'm going to have an article within the next week or two at Mises.org explaining this. All right, that now what the only thing he can possibly mean by that is that he's focusing on the distinction between what's called the monetary base or reserves. Those terms aren't interchangeable, but I'm saying either one of those quantities has gone up a tremendous amount since the crisis began, like almost doubling the monetary base, and the reserves are just through the roof. And so he can't mean that. So when you say, has the Fed been printing money, if you just mean generically the amount of dollar bills or dollar claims against the Fed that exist, has that gone up? Well, then yes, it has, tremendously. So all he can possibly mean is the actual green pieces of paper with pictures of the president on them. But even there, that has gone up. I mean, it depends what you mean when you say significantly, because he catches himself. If you go and watch the interview again on YouTube, that relevant part, you see he catches, I'm not going to remember the exact wording, but he says something like this. He goes, you know, there's this idea out there that the Fed's printing money. We're not printing money. This quantity of money hasn't gone up in any significant way. So even there, he hedged himself. Because yes, the amount of physical currency, green pieces of paper, has gone up. If you look at a chart of it, and that's what I'm going to show in my article, it was flat for several years, and then right at the end of 2008, when Bernanke started doing all his crazy stuff, it zooms up. All right, and so even if you just restrict yourself to talking about green pieces of paper, the Fed has been printing money. Well, technically, they get the Treasury to do it, or the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which I think is part of the Treasury. So there, the only way he could possibly be telling the truth, and that's, like I said, why I think you see he catches himself, is at first he makes the strong claim that they haven't been printing money, and then he kind of backs off that and says, in any significant way. So, again, it depends what you mean by significant. So, ironically, you know, so if there had been no crisis and Bernanke hadn't been injecting $1 trillion in new reserves into the system, if you just looked at what he did with currency, people might say, whoa, you're printing a lot of money, aren't you, Ben? So it's funny when he says now, well, not in any significant way. The only thing that significant can mean in reference to is how much reserves he's creating. So really all he's saying is, No, if you look at how much inflation I'm putting into the banking sector, the amount of inflation I'm creating in terms of the paper currency is nothing. So why are you guys accusing me of printing money? You know, it's almost like that's what he's saying. Like, you know, get your facts straight when you go and accuse me of how I'm doing the inflating. Make sure you realize that, you know, where my real mischief has been. It's not over here in printing money. It's over here in bank reserves. So that's one thing. Now, you're right, Benjamin, too, on the second point that I pointed this out in the article I had a few weeks ago. So lots of people, when he had that 60 Minutes interview, were focused on that one section saying, what a liar. And then there's a big debate over was Bernanke telling the truth when he said he wasn't printing money. And, you know, some people were defending him. Other people were saying he's a liar, all that stuff. But the thing that most shocked me or whatever, alarmed me, is when on this issue of inflation, by which they meant price inflation, and the interviewer says to him, how confident are you in your ability? Well, just let's back up a second. So Bernanke is saying, you know, we have all kinds of tools. You know, we could raise interest rates in 15 minutes if we wanted to. So he's trying to say that, you know, there's no issue of inflation. There's no danger of runaway price inflation. And so then the interviewer comes back and says, how confident are you in your ability to turn this thing around if you need to? And he says, 100%, which is just crazy. I mean, I understand if you're in a public position like that, you don't want to spook the markets and stuff, but it's in the article it says Bernanke can't be 100% sure he can operate his toaster correctly. What I actually had in the first draft, but we decided it would be too risque, as I said, Bernanke can't be 100% sure he can sleep through the night without wetting the bed or something like that, but we decided to change the example. But you get the point. There's all kinds of stuff that can happen, right? Bernanke might not make it into work that day. You know, there could be the power could go out, and it might take more than 15 minutes for them to raise interest rates. There could be a piano could fall off a building and hit him in the head, right? So he clearly is overrating his ability to turn the thing around. And I don't even mean just silly stuff like, what if he gets stuck in a traffic jam or something? I mean, there's all kinds of things that could happen that would make Bernanke powerless to reverse course. So for example, let's say, and this is the thing that I talk about when people try to ask me, you know, how could it all break down in a day? Well, suppose, and I'm not predicting that this will happen, I'm just saying something like this could happen, and so I can't stand it when people are just saying, oh no, but the Fed has all kinds of tools. If inflation starts getting out of hand, they'll just unwind it. What if the Chinese finance minister or somebody is given a press conference, and he says something in Chinese, and then the translator just changes ever so slightly the nuance, and it comes off as, you know, maybe what he really was saying is we're going to slow the rate of growth in our holdings of U.S. treasuries or something like that. And then maybe that gets translated as we are no longer going to buy U.S. treasuries. And then the world says, whoa. And then they read into it and they think that really what he means, if that's what he said, what he really means is we're dumping treasuries tomorrow. And so then everyone just starts trying to get out first. And so people around the world start dumping treasuries. And then because that happens, other people say, whoa, whoa, and they start doing it. So like it could start a chain reaction. And then, you know, the dollar might drop 20% in a day. I mean, that could happen. The stock market has dropped more than 20% in a day. Back in 1987, I think it dropped more than 20% in a day. Right? So the dollar, that's possible. And then you'd say, well, what would go on there? And so the Fed might have to raise interest rates, and so, but that wouldn't contain the price inflation. I mean, that would just try to keep it from completely exploding. And then interest rates start going up, all right? And so you might be able to contain the price inflation in one respect, you know, so that would, like, slide the appreciation. So in other words, if the dollar drops 20% against other currencies, then that means everything we import all of a sudden is 20% more expensive. So if oil had been $100, it would instantly be $120. All right. And so, you know, if gas were $3 a gallon, it would presumably jump up to, what, $3.60. Okay. So that's the idea. And the Fed could try to reverse that because they said, well, how do we make the dollar appreciate? They could really tighten. So they could jack up interest rates. But then, you know, you get into the issue, okay, so they jack up the interest rates. And if the excess reserves were if the excess reserves were where they normally are, near zero, okay, so yeah, you would just crash the economy. It would be like what Volcker did in 1982, right? Just tighten up, meaning they stop printing so much money. That makes interest rates go up. The economy crashes, but you get price inflation under control. The thing is, though, right now, if they try to do that, so again, if the dollar falls for some other reason and the Fed realizes, holy cow, we have to, if we don't want Walmart to have to raise all their prices by 20% because now all the imports that Walmart gets from China and elsewhere go up by 20%. So if we want to, if we don't want Americans going to the store, going to Walmart to see prices go up 20% this year, we have to make the dollar appreciate against other currencies. And the only way to do that is to significantly tighten and to raise interest rates so that now investors want to get back into U.S. assets, right? Because that was the deal, that people, whatever reason, if they start dumping treasuries because they think the U.S. government's going to default or just because they see that China's doing it and so they want to get out of treasuries before China does, if that's what's happening, how do you get people to be willing to hold treasuries again? You have to raise the interest rate. And so that's what they would try to do, right? So that people want to get back into it, because now if a 3-month T-bill is paying 5%, people are more likely to want to put their money into it rather than right now when it's paying, I don't know what it's paying, but it's very low. All right, so they start doing that, but now because of the situation we're currently in, this was what might happen. So the Fed tightens, right? And they jack up interest rates, and so now 3-month T-bills and longer-term treasuries are yielding 5% and more for longer-term stuff. Okay, and Bernanke's right. He's, yeah, we did in 15 minutes. Okay, but now let's think about what's happening. So the banks are sitting on all these excess reserves. And even if Bernanke got rid of half of them, like maybe that's the way they tighten. They just start selling off all these assets to tighten down and raise interest rates. So maybe, I'm just picking numbers out of the air here. I have to do it more carefully to make the numbers all fit together with this story. But let's just say Bernanke sells off $500 billion of assets in 15 minutes. Right? And he's saying, see, I told you guys, I'm a hard, tough guy. I don't care about crushing the economy. I'll do what it takes to contain price inflation. All right, so he just completely devastates the banking sector and the real estate industry because he sells off $500 billion of mortgage-backed securities, right? So now all the big banks and whatever that were still holding those securities, they just got wiped out again, right? Bernanke in 15 minutes would have just undone everything, all of his so-called rescue efforts to date, right? He would have to do that, right? Because everybody now holding all his mortgage-backed securities, when Bernanke sells 500 billion of them, that's going to make their price plummet. And so now all these institutions that thought they were finally out of the woods, oops, now they're all bankrupt again. Because on their books, if they have to mark to market, the stuff they're still holding, the mortgage-backed securities, now just get crushed in price because the Fed just dumped $500 billion worth. Okay, so now they're all insolvent again. Okay, so now, boom, we've got the same situation we had in the fall of 2008, where the whole financial sector is going to collapse because all the big banks are insolvent and they're all intertwined, and if one goes down, they're going to take them all down. Okay, so now we've got the same problem we had back in the fall of 2008, but guess what? On top of that, we still have $500 billion of excess reserves in the system. Because again, pulling numbers out of the air, I said maybe to raise interest rates to what they think they had to do, the Fed undoes half of what it's done to date. So there's still $500 billion in excess reserves in the system, and now 3-month T-bills are yielding 5% because they jacked up interest rates. So now you're a bank, and you know either you just got wiped out because of what Bernanke did, or maybe you're unscathed because you weren't holding a bunch of mortgage-backed securities, okay? So now you're sitting there, and the Fed is paying you 0.25% if you keep your excess reserves parked there, or you can go buy T-bills now and earn 5%. So what are you going to do? You're going to go buy T-bills. And so the money that was parked, bottled up in excess reserves, is going to now go to primary dealers who are holding T-bills, because now the banks are going to want to start buying those. And that by itself doesn't allow more money to be created, but that money does get spent in the one round, right? The people who get that cash now can do something with it. They can go buy a Ferrari if they want to, and that ultimately, you know, funnels around the system. But the point is, now interest rates in general are higher, and so other interest rates are going to start going up too. And so now somebody might come and want to say to the bank, hey, can I apply for a loan because I want to go expand my factory or whatever, because now prices are rising, and I'll pay you 5%, and or I'll pay you 10% if T-bill rate's 5%. And so now the bank can start lending out money, and those excess reserves are going to start flowing out. And so now you're going to have the same financial crisis that you had in September 2008, but laid on top of that, you're going to have the possible creation of $5 trillion in new money, right? Because there's $500 billion in excess reserves. And so if the banks fully lend that out with a reserve ratio of 10% back of the envelope, that allows the banking system to create $5 trillion more of, you know, M1, checking account balances. Oops. And so now what's Bernanke going to do? So yeah, he could crush it even more. There's two things he could do. You could say, oh, well, no, he'll just sell off everything. But that's the problem. Think about it this way. The way that Bernanke got those reserves into the system is he bought assets, mortgage-backed securities and things, for a certain amount of money. And he, in fact, I would say overpaid for them. He paid more than what anyone in the market would have paid at the time. And so he writes checks on the Fed, creates round numbers. He buys $1 trillion worth of stuff. But now you say, so worst case scenario, he could just undo all that, right? He could just sell that stuff, suck $1 trillion back out of the financial sector. Well, no, because what if, because the crisis happens and now people are freaking out, what if Bernanke tries to sell the actual securities that he bought? Yeah, suppose he tries to clear off the Fed's books and sell everything that he's bought since September 2008, but what if he can only get $700 billion for it? That, you know, he took a $300 billion hit on the value of those assets. So that means even if he's completely draconian and he does everything in his power to undo the inflation he's already pumped in and he just wants to suck it all back out, if he suffers a big capital loss beforehand, he can't do it. Even if he sells it all back, he will have only sucked $700 billion out. So now there's going to be $300 billion still sitting in the system. If interest rates are high, banks are going to start lending it out. And now that can create $3 trillion of new money. And there's nothing he can do. The one thing he can do is he can offer to pay higher reserves, a higher interest rate on excess reserves. So instead of doing what he's doing right now and paying 0.25%, the Fed can say to the banks, wait, instead of you lending that money out, how about we'll pay you 4%? So don't risk your money. Don't lend it to some business at 8% when they might default. Keep it parked with us at 4%. Because you know we're not going to default, because we can just create money out of thin air. So the banks say, okay, and they do that. But then, again, you've got now the problem just growing exponentially. That now, instead of having the $300 billion in reserves that you're wondering how are we going to suck that out because we have no assets left as the Fed, now you've got $300 billion that's going to grow at an APR of 4% a year. And if interest rates keep rising, the Fed will have to keep bumping up that interest rate, making the problem grow exponentially at a faster and faster rate. Okay, so I'm not predicting that things would go exactly the way I just said, but what I am saying is the people who are just saying, oh no, but Bernanke has all these tools, he could turn around a dime if he wanted to, they're not even addressing the kind of problems that I just brought up, right? I mean, that's not science fiction what I just said. That is a very plausible scenario, maybe not in the exact particulars, but something like that could happen. And, you know, people are acting. So if, let me put it this way. The, what people have in mind when they say Bernanke could turn it around is they're picturing a very gradual thing that, you know, 1 month CPI rises an annualized rate of 1.2%, then the next month it rises by 1.3, and then 1.6 and 1.8. So that 6 months into it, you start to say, uh-oh, it looks like price inflation's kicking up. We better start to tighten. And then they just gradually do it, and then, you know, maybe unemployment bumps up a little bit, but, you know, okay. But no one's dealing with the possibility of what if there is a crash and a new crisis comes upon us in a day? Then what are we going to do? And Bernanke's, all the tools and stuff he has at his disposal, he would have to devastate the financial sector and the housing market to even do anything to stop it even temporarily. And then the other main option he has is, again, is to pay higher interest rates on the banks to bribe them to not make loans to keep that money bottled up, but that would just make the problem grow exponentially. So one sort of empirical thing is to, because occasionally I catch myself and I wonder, am I just, you know, being completely paranoid? And what if this is going to be fine? And yeah, we're in a long haul, 10-year sort of sluggishness with low, like a Japanese lost decade. But the sort of thing that makes me think, no, I don't think that's the case is, all right, for one thing, as you guys probably know, I mean, commodity prices are exploding. There's literally food riots around the world because people can't afford to eat and buy energy. So that's sort of odd. And then also, the fact that accounting rule changed, to me, that really is a very disturbing signal. So that thing that happened in January 6th, and I sent you guys the Mises.org that I did on that, I think, about that rule shift that the Fed announced as to how it would treat its surplus earnings, which if you flipped it and said, well, what if the Fed happened to lose money, how would it treat it? And that the accounting now is such that they would reflect a loss as a negative liability to the Treasury, that they wouldn't take a hit to their capital. To me, that looks like the Fed is getting ready to be able to handle huge losses on its portfolio, which would happen if interest rates spiked or if the real estate market collapsed. You know, people started defaulting on their mortgages more than they've already been doing. Then the Fed would take a huge hit on its mortgage-backed securities and its the bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So to me, I think the Fed is just getting prepared to weather the storm of it having its capital completely wiped out. And that's why it implemented that weird rule change. So, you know, in terms of little bits of evidence here and there as to, you know, how do we know that this crazy paranoid worldview you have is actually what's going on? It's stuff like that that makes me think, because if everything were really fine and Bernanke really thought he had 100% confidence that he could just turn the whole thing around on a dime if he needed to, I don't, that rule change seems like, what would you do that for then? And I don't believe it was because they wanted to promote transparency, because the rule change itself was completely obscure. Like, it took people a while to even figure out what the Fed was talking about. So that hardly seems like it was something done to make sure financial markets were let in on the secret. Okay, back to the questions. Rob says, where do you think we're headed from here? QE3 is on the way, probably in June. The bankers at Davos, Switzerland proposed adding $100 trillion in liquidity over, it says next year's. I think you meant next year's, probably. Where's this all headed? Oh, over the next 10 years. Okay, you clarified. Davis, $100 trillion over the next 10 years. Using, you say SDBs. I don't know. Is that the same thing as SDRs? Was it special drawing rights as proposed by the IMF? So, yeah, you clarify later. Okay. So, just so people know what's going on. Yeah, I've been working on some other stuff, meeting deadlines, so I haven't been able to follow the discussions about QE3 and what's going on in Davos, Switzerland too carefully, but, you know, reading the headlines and just a few things, yeah. I think you're right that we're going to be chugging along. The economy is going to sputter and start to seem to run out of gas. And so what's the solution going to be? Well, let's just pump in more money. That QE1, it seems to have energized the stock market. Remember, if you look at the S&P 500, for example, it was plummeting through the crisis in the fall of 2008 through December. Now, you could say it was because Obama got elected and people were worried, or you could just say it was the economy in general is collapsing, who knows. But for whatever reason, the stock market kept plummeting, and then it flipped around in March of 2009, and then it started zooming up again. So if you look at like a long-term, like 10-year history of the stock market, it's very disturbing that it looks, you know, from an Austrian point of view, that the bubble's brewing through the housing boom years, then it starts crashing, and then now it seems like they've inflated it back up about, you know, 75%. So, which is why it wouldn't surprise me at all if the stock market crashed again this year, just because they keep, you know, again, look at like a 10-year, look at a long enough period so you can see the dot-com bubble and then pop, and then the housing bubble and pop, and it looks like they're just doing it again. So it would not surprise me if in the next year or two the stock market crashes again. So, so Rob is pointing out that they're just going to keep doing rounds of quantitative easing. And I think you're right that from their perspective, there's no downside to it, right? As long as consumer prices apparently are steady, you know, that they're not out of hand, they're just going to keep doing that. And that's also why I think it's so important that they've established this new metric of the core CPI, because already food and energy prices are rising at alarming rates, and producer prices are rising at alarming rates, especially if you look at like the crude index and things. And so the only thing that's not rising, at least according to the official measures, at alarming rates, is if you look at consumer prices excluding food and energy. And now if you think about that, that's not surprising, right? That in the environment we're in, loosely speaking, Bernanke is pumping a ton of money in one end of the system, and on the other end, you've got consumers who are up to their ears in debt, and there's 10% official unemployment and much higher unemployment, you know, using various other measures. So they're not going to be going out spending their money on non-necessities. So it's not, you know, so in this environment now, what we've established is prices on all sorts of things like gold, stocks, commodities, just producer goods in general are all blown through the roof. And the one thing that's not going up in price is stuff that consumers can defer their spending on. And so, you know, it's like, well, gee, is that really all that shocking? And should we be totally relieved and say, well, there's no inflation problem like Paul Krugman's been saying? So I think not. But so, to answer your question, I think, yeah, as long as they can continue to have people believe that inflation isn't here yet, meaning price inflation, why wouldn't they just keep pumping in more money? Because when they do that, again, it's not like these rounds of quantitative easing have no effect anywhere. No, if you're the person selling stuff to the Fed, you certainly benefit from it, even if just charging, you know, the service fee. If you're like the primary dealer who's handling those transactions, you benefit from that, if nothing else, just from getting the extra business. So they clearly would want to do that. And of course the government likes it because now they get another buyer for their bonds. So as the federal government continues to run huge deficits, the one thing that has kept people from totally flipping out about the government's big deficits is the fact that interest rates on treasuries are so low. So that, you know, Keynesians can plausibly say, what are you guys talking about? The markets don't think that we're spending too much money. You know, interest rate, you know, yields on treasuries are lower now than they were under Ronald Reagan. So clearly the markets aren't worried about the treasury being able to pay off all this debt. But if it turns out that, well, if most of the new debt is being soaked up by the Fed, then it's not so obvious that that's what's holding down yields. And then everybody else is just sort of going along for the ride. Like, so in other words, I think there is a bubble right now in treasuries, and that's going to pop, and you're going to see yields on treasuries go way up. And I think after the fact, people are going to look at that and say, what in the world were we thinking? The federal government was running $1.5 trillion deficits, projecting that over 10 years, you know, the debt to GDP level was going to mushroom, and we had historically low yields on that. What the heck were we thinking? Just like now looking back at the housing bubble years, people say, what were we thinking? But when it's in the moment, you can come up with all sorts of rationalizations. So anyway, that's my long-winded way of saying, yeah, I think they're going to keep doing rounds of QE until price inflation gets to be so bad that even the Bureau of Labor Statistics can't sweep it under the rug, and they're going to have to admit, yeah, price inflation is getting out of hand. I mean, it's getting pretty crazy. There's literally riots all over the place. There are various governments around the world that are falling. And even in the United States, that's happening at the state levels. That there are huge riots, not the word, huge demonstrations and protests from public sector employees because of proposals to cut their funding and so on that these state governments have to do because they're running big deficits and they don't have a printing press. So it's... What I'm going to be curious to see is how far they'll let that go. If the Fed's just going to stand back and let all these state and local governments twist in the wind and just, you know, devastate some of these public sector unions, or if the Fed is somehow going to come in and come up with some crazy rationale by which the Fed will buy California state bonds, for example. I mean, if that happens, then I think, oh my gosh, the dollar is truly, you know, on its last legs. Whereas if the Fed doesn't intervene and lets some of these local governments go bankrupt and default on their municipal bonds and stuff like that, then I'll think, okay, maybe the ultimate game plan isn't to totally wreck the dollar. Maybe, you know, they're not that crazy. But if they come in and start bailing out even state and local governments and have the Fed monetize their debt just to get through this crisis, then I think, you know, I don't know, that they really are destroying the dollar. Okay, Matteo says, there's a lot of press about the state of the states. Has the Fed ever purchased muni bonds? And if states turn out to be in the shape some predict, do you think the Fed will start to purchase muni bonds? Okay, so I actually didn't see your question, so that's just a coincidence that you asked what I just talked about. Yeah, I mean, so it's bad. State level stuff, it's bad. And I think the reason it's so disturbing is that it's so widespread, right? Because, I mean, like, the California state government has a fiscal crisis, like, every 7 years or something, if you go back to through the 80s. So, I mean, that always happens in California, that they, and part of it's because of their tax system is very what's called progressive, right? So they have a lot of tax brackets, even just at the state level. And they're very heavily dependent on capital gains. So if the California economy is booming and they're having a good year and the people in Silicon Valley are making tons of money, revenues to Sacramento are really high, like disproportionately high. And so, like, in other words, like, if their economy goes up by 5%, revenues to the state government go up by way more than 5%, is what I'm trying to say. So it, like, exaggerates the boom revenues. And so then the legislature starts spending a bunch of money. They start hiring more public sector employees. They sign generous contracts in terms of their pensions and all that. So they build in all this future spending that they're on the hook for. And then when the economy tanks, maybe when somebody else is governor, so they don't care about it, now all of a sudden revenues dry up. And so even if the economy just goes down 5%, revenues go down more than 5%. And so that's, and especially like with the real estate market doing what it did, these states that had big swings in the property markets, well, they get crushed because a lot of their revenue, especially at the local level, is due to property taxes. And for some of these places, that's now just fully kicking in because there's a lag in terms of when they reassess the property value. So even though, like, so some properties, their price might have crashed 20% 2 years ago, but maybe those people had to keep paying property taxes based on the old assessments until this year. Now, finally, most of them have been revalued as far as the, you know, local government tax agencies are concerned. And so now people are paying the same property tax rate on a much lower valued piece of real estate. And so that's another reason. So besides, so it's not just the fact that people are unemployed, and so not as many people are paying income taxes and sales taxes because they're not spending as much. And it's also not just that the governments have to pay more in food stamps and you know, other forms of welfare checks and whatever, but on top of all that, their property values in their regions are way down in some of these places. And so they're just, you know, so these places, a lot of their revenue streams are just way down, and they're expected to spend more because they have all these so-called social safety net programs. So these places are just getting killed. And, but like I said, the thing that's what makes this so unique, if you will, is that that's happening all over the country. It's not just particular states are in trouble. It is a more general thing. And so now it's like the exception is if there's a state that's not running a huge deficit that has, you know, done its accounting and kept its spending in check so that it's able to handle the storm. So I don't know what's going to happen, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's the fact that various governors are trying to take away collective bargaining rights from unions, that surprises me. I mean, that just because that's such a bold move. Then I think I think they wouldn't be doing that unless the fiscal situation really were in crisis. Because again, that's like the flip side of the Rahm Emanuel thing. Don't let a crisis go to waste. So just like people who are trying to expand government will try to rush through something that the public wouldn't approve during normal times. When there's a crisis, it goes the other way too here, that I think a lot of these who tend to be Republican governors and legislatures and whatever that want to break the backs of the unions, it's probably true that they're using this as an opportunity. But the point is, under normal circumstances, if a governor just came along and said, hey, you know what, we're going to take away bargaining rights from teachers, he'd get crushed, right? Because the teachers would march, they'd stop going to school, they'd strike, and the average person would say, what, you want to take away a fundamental right of the labor unions for teachers? What, are you crazy? But now people are just mad that they don't want to pay more taxes. There's, you know, the people are unemployed, they're struggling, and then they hear how much some of these teachers are making per year, and then now the teachers aren't teaching their kids because they're too busy protesting. I think a lot of these people are saying, you know what? Fine, yeah, let hang these people out to dry. It's time we cut them down. So anyway, it's a serious situation, and I don't know how it's going to go, but like I said, that there's two main things as far as the Fed is concerned. They can just say that's not our business and stay back and just let it play out, and maybe the federal government will try to come in and bail some of them out. So if that happens, I mean, that will be bad to my mind, but that's not like, that doesn't mean the dollar is in trouble. But if, like I say, if Bernanke himself starts selectively bailing out individual municipalities and state governments, then, I mean, that's just crazy. And so to answer your question, I don't think the Fed has ever done that before. I could be wrong, but I don't think the Fed has ever done that before. I think historically the Fed was just supposed to be buying federal government securities precisely because you didn't want the Fed being able to pick winners and losers. You didn't want the Fed influencing individual markets or, you know, giving preference to one group over another. But, I mean, Bernanke has been bailing out investment banks by name behind the scenes to the tune of billions of dollars. So clearly he would have the... If California is going to have to lay off 50,000 state workers, and then Bernanke comes in and basically lends California $100 billion when all is said and done, so they don't have to lay them off, I don't think anybody's going to object, except people like me and, you know, some others, Sean Hannity or something, you know, people associated with the Mises Institute, and people who don't like Democrats. But I mean, I think the average person is going to say, oh, thanks, Big Ben. You looked out for us there. And so it's, he would be able to do it. And, you know, he could set all kinds of systemic risk. And, you know, we can't let that happen. If California falls, then, you know, that would spook investors and blah, blah, blah. So, but if he does do that, like I say, then that, I think, is going to just seal the deal that they are not serious, that Bernanke really is just going to keep inflating until the dollar collapses. Whereas if he doesn't do that, then I'll be more open-minded and say, okay, maybe he really is just trying to save this ship, and but isn't completely reckless. So that's why I'm curious to see what happens with this issue of state and local government. Okay, Matteo says, I would like to hear your thoughts on how the BLS captures U.S. inflation in its current calculation. So here, I mean, there's lots of different things. So one big issue is that regular CPI compared to core CPI. So core takes out food and energy prices. And I should just be clear that if you look at the headline CPI number, so when the BLS reports the consumer price index, that main number has food and energy in it. All right, so don't, if you're going to be complaining to people, just be careful that it's not like we are ignorant of what the number would be if it had food and energy in it. So the Fed does officially report that, and that is still the main official CPI number. And most financial stories are respect that. And if they say CPI, they should mean regular CPI. And they ought to be putting the word core in if they mean with food and energy taken out. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that I think the regular CPI number is legitimate. I mean, there's all kinds of tricks they can do. And it's not... it's not that they're lying. I just want to be clear about that. So, but the problem is when it comes to discussing how do you measure consumer price changes, it's not an exact science because it's things change. And I'll give you a couple examples in a minute. And so you could, you know, somebody who is completely apolitical, who's just coming with a fresh mind to the topic, might endorse some of the techniques that the Fed can do to massage the numbers, but my point is, if the Fed knows, or sorry, if the Bureau of Labor and Statistics knows that the official story is that right now we're still in danger of deflation, and that's what they're supposed to be cranking out, well, they have all kinds of ways they can do that, right? Because it's a very loosey-goosey calculation. And there's not like an objectively right way to calculate price inflation. And so that's the problem. So it's not that the average rank and file economist on the staff or on the payroll of the BLS goes to work every day knowing, you know, we're falsifying numbers here to fool the public. They don't even, that's not even necessary for my view. What I am saying is I think they know as an institution that the official story that Bernanke's been telling people and that Paul Krugman are telling people is that we are in danger of slipping into a Japanese-style lost decade where prices keep falling, and that's why the Fed's doing all the stuff it's doing. And there's no danger of inflation, and that, you know, Bernanke could turn around on a dime if he needed to. And so given that, I think they choose how to solve these problems or these different ways you could go with a certain calculation, they choose to answer those questions in ways that suppress what the official inflation number is going to be. So, for example, one thing they can do is what's called hedonic adjustments. So you could say, well, has the price of computers gone up over the last 5 years? And so one naive thing would be to go look at what a brand new laptop from Hewlett-Packard cost 5 years ago, and then look at their brand new laptop today and see, did the price go up? But then you could say, well, wait a minute, that's a laptop today is a lot more powerful and better in other respects than a laptop from 5 years ago. So we have to include some sort of quality adjustment there. And so that gives you a way of suppressing the price. So even if it's true that a laptop today, a new laptop costs 10% more dollars than a new laptop 5 years ago, you might say, but you know what, it's 50% better. And so really, in that respect, laptops are 35% cheaper today than they were 5 years ago. Because for your dollar, you get a lot more computing power. And so the price of cool computing power has actually gone way down in the last 5 years. And so you'd plug that into the CPI and show that the price of laptops has gone way down. Even though if you just looked at the sticker price, you might say, well, no, actually they're a little bit more expensive now than they were 5 years ago. Or you know, you could do the same thing with cars. You could say, is a car more expensive today than it was in 1920? And well, yeah, because back in 19, I think a Model T, I don't remember how much they were. It was like $600 or something, I think. But I might be wrong about that. But it certainly wasn't $20,000 back then, because $20,000 would have been a small fortune. But you say, so has an automobile gotten more expensive? Has the price of a Ford gone up? Well, yeah, if you just look at the price tag. But on the other hand, a Ford Taurus is incredibly cooler than a Model T was. And so it's not even the same product, really. So you have problems like that, and I'm just giving you exaggerated examples. But so it's not that it's dishonest to take into account quality and changes, but my point is that's kind of a subjective thing. There's all kinds of ways you can model that. And so if you know the answer has to be we have low price inflation, because that's what the official story is, you can come up with ways to make that happen. Another dimension of wiggle room they have is and this one I think is really weird, whereas the quality adjustments I kind of understand why they do that, it makes sense. But this other one I don't think makes much sense is they say, look, suppose the price of hamburger goes up 20% in a given year. Well, are we going to include that in the CPI and say that, you know, whatever component of hamburgers was of people's budgets, that now it's that much more expensive? They say, well, no, because people wouldn't buy as much hamburger. If hamburger meat really went up 20% in a year, but chicken only went up 5%, well, then households that used to buy a lot of hamburger are probably going to switch out of that and buy more chicken. And so we're not going to report the full 20% increase. We're going to only report, you know, 10% increase or something, because people aren't going to just keep buying the same mix of products they did before. The products that went way up in price, they'll buy less of, and the products that either went down in price or went up a little bit, they'll buy more of. So the idea is, even if the raw prices themselves, even after you adjusted for quality and all that, if they went up 10% on average, you would mitigate that and really only ding people and say, well, no, since we're allowing you to adjust your purchases, really it's like prices only went up 8%. And so their argument is, for a given household to be able to get as much utility, or you know, as happiness from going out and buying stuff in the world from the marketplace, it only is going to cost you 8% more to do that, even though, you know, the prices on average of the stuff you bought last year went up 10%, we're only going to count that as an 8% increase, because ultimately what you care about is how much happiness you get. And so if some things go way up in price and other things go up a little bit, you'll just buy, you'll get your happiness from the things that went up lower in price. And so you substitute out of it. All right, so that's the idea. So again, I mean, it's not, I understand why you could think that, and there are plenty of free market economists who think that's a perfectly sensible adjustment to make. But again, the point is that given all these little tricks that the BLS has, they can massage the numbers. And so, it's not like in the middle of the Weimar Republic in Germany that they could have reported stable prices. You know, everyone would have known they were nuts. So the same thing here. I think at some point, prices are going to be going up so much that the BLS is even going to have to admit, okay, yeah, we've got serious inflation. But I'm just saying right now, when it's just starting to hit in various sectors and things, there's lots of tricks they can use to keep down those monthly numbers and make it look like the problem's not as bad. And then, oh, this is just anecdotal stuff. But, in the, you know, the broad scheme of things, prices are still pretty constant. Okay, R. Gonzel says, are you guys hedging, protecting yourself from inflation? If so, how are you guys doing it? I'm not sure if you're asking me or just the other people in the thing, but yeah, one obvious thing is if you have revolving debt that's a variable rate, so like if you're carrying credit card balances or if you own a house and you have a variable rate mortgage, things like that, or you know, just have a personal line of credit and the APR adjusts based on the prime rate or something like that, then yeah, I would get out of that if I were you, because I think interest rates are going to spike. Now, I know some people, I have a friend who was considering switching his fixed rate mortgage to, what do you call that? To an adjustable rate mortgage, because he was just running the numbers and thought, you know, he could save so much in the first, as long as his interest rates stayed low for another year. He was just running the numbers and thought he could save so much that even if interest rates reset much higher, that he would still, you know, he could refinance at that point and get back to a fixed rate and it would all, you know, he would still make more money. So I mean, I'm not saying this is going to be necessarily true for every single person, but I would just say in general, if you're exposed, if a jump in interest rates would devastate you, then I think you should prepare yourself for that. And so, like I say, if you're carrying a big credit card balance, just keep in mind those things typically, you know, maybe you did like a balance transfer and it's 3.99% for life. Okay, then you're fine. But if you're carrying a balance that is based, you know, it's like some percentage point increase based off the prime rate, just keep in mind that might double over the next 12 months. So that kind of thing, that's one obvious way you can protect yourself if big price inflation comes and interest rates rise. You make sure that, you know, you don't get wiped out that way. Yeah, buying gold and silver coins, and it depends what level you're talking about. So I'm here talking about like somebody who's a younger person or, you know, middle class. I'm not talking about what you do with like your big finances, like with your retirement portfolio if you're 60. I'm more talking about younger people who just don't want to get wiped out. And so one pretty simple thing to do is just go buy some junk silver, meaning go to a coin shop and just say, can I get, if you say to them junk silver, they'll know what you mean. But it means U.S. coins that are like pre-1962. Okay, so before then, quarters and dimes and nickels had actual silver content. You can go to Google and see for yourself and see the different amounts. So, you know, it's the reason I like that is, let's say big price inflation comes, it'll be easier for you to get other Americans to trust that, you know, if you hold up a quarter and say, look at, see that this is a U.S. quarter, right? And say, oh yeah. And say, what's the year? Let's say it's 1948. And you can say, go look at Google. Look up 1948 U.S. quarter and see how much silver is in there. And they can go do that. And then you can see what's, you know, the market price of silver, right? You know, maybe it's $100 an ounce or something because inflation's so bad. And so you can say, see, so with this quarter, now you know what this thing is, and I want to buy whatever, a bunch of food from you or something, or I want to trade it for a bunch of dollars. My point is that I think Americans who aren't used to dealing with bullion and coins of numismatic value and things, they will much more readily accept your claims that this stuff has silver in it, as opposed to if you try to give them, you know, if you go in there with a, I don't know, something issued from the Australian Mint or something, that you're saying, look at this goalkeeper, they might be squeamish. Okay, so that's why I think just having some silver in the form of coins that were minted in the U.S. before the 1960s is one good way to just get a bunch of actual precious metal in your possession. And so that the point of that, it's not that you're going to be a millionaire. Well, you could be a millionaire, but that won't mean anything. The point's not so that you're living high. The point is just if there is a sudden crash and prices jump, that will give you a little bit of a cushion. Because I think ultimately, again, at least for people who are still working, the way you're going to get, what's going to end up happening is eventually wages will rise and salaries will rise. And so we'll all adjust to the new equilibrium. So once, you know, there's a devaluation, eventually it'll be the point where it'll be like you're starting from scratch. And so the point to my mind of for regular Joes, especially, you know, younger people who are just starting out, the point's not so that you make all these expert investments so that when the crash happens, you're like, yes, now I'm really rich. The point is you don't get completely wiped out so that you have no wealth at all, that you want to have something that's going to carry you over and tide you over for a year or 18 months until prices sort of, you know, renormalize, and that you're getting paid from your employer enough to be able to buy food and to make your renter payments. Whereas, you know, because there might be that transition period where the inflation hits and dollar prices all zoom up, but your paycheck stays the same. And so that, because that's the actual way, the mechanism by which the people who get the money first redistribute wealth from the people who had it before, is that prices go up, the people who get the new money from Bernanke first can pay the prices because they have the extra money, and the other people are just sitting there flat-footed, and holy cow, and all of a sudden gasoline costs $20 a gallon, and I'm still making $8 an hour, or whatever, $15 an hour from my job at a factory, and I get crushed. And so I have to sell my house and, you know, move into a little dinky apartment, and I got to sell off my wife's jewelry, and I got to sell my car. And so when it comes down to it, all of a sudden I had a nice middle-class existence, and now I'm working 60 hours a week just to live the way that somebody that I would have considered poor lived 2 years ago. And so that's what can happen. So the point of you having a stockpile of gold and silver coins and not having debts that are going to adjust and go up in interest rates when interest rates spike, the point of that is so that you just don't get completely wiped out. So in that kind of scenario, yeah, it might take a year or two for your paycheck to rise to make you able to keep your standard of living. And in the meantime, you know, your stockpile of gold and silver coins jumped up in value. And so you draw them down and use that to go, you know, buy the $20 gas and pay for your groceries and keep paying your landlord while you're waiting for your, you know, paycheck to rise to compensate. Okay, we got time for one more question. Rob says, I guess I'm of the conspiracy camp. I think the Fed will crash the dollar to bring in the global SDR and a European Union-type formal economic political structure. Is this idea completely impossible in your opinion? No, I don't think it's completely impossible at all. I mean, it's not impossible because we just discussed it and it could happen. It happened in Europe, right? So I confess I have not done enough research to know that this is the case, but you hear people in this sort of, with this sort of worldview claiming things like the same people that were behind the move to bring the euro into, you know, the euro area, so that to get rid of the individual currencies that the European nations had before, and then just now they're all on the euro, that there are certain powerful banking interests behind that. And whether you think that's sinister or not, clearly there were people who were in favor of that, and they were funding the campaign for it and, you know, bankrolling the think tanks that had academics talking about it and organizing conferences and stuff. So whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, there were clearly certain groups that were pushing that. And so I've heard people claim that it's the same groups that are now, you know, behind what the Fed's doing, and that they would like to see the Amero or something like it, you know, so a regional currency in North America to get rid of the dollar, the Canadian U.S. dollars and the Mexican currency, and to replace them all with a single currency. So as far as, you know, who would benefit from that kind of arrangement? Well, if you just think about it, if you are running a printing press, the bigger the jurisdiction in which the currency is the common money, the better that is for you. All right. So right now, if you had to choose, if someone said, hey, I'm going to let you control one of the printing presses, you can control the Federal Reserve, so you can be in charge of how many dollars are created, and you can determine, you know, you can just create dollars and hand them out to your buddies, or you can create Zimbabwe dollars and hand them out to your buddies. Which one do you want? I think it's obvious that you would much rather have control of the U.S. printing press, because you could create additional quantities of that would buy you certain things in the market without making the currency fall as much. Whereas, you know, you start printing more Zimbabwe dollars, you could buy some cars and stuff, but you can't go and buy Switzerland, because if you printed up enough currency to go buy Switzerland, it would just crash in value. Okay, whereas Bernanke has found he can go buy $1 trillion worth of stuff while the dollar still strengthens. Okay, so that's the idea. So the bigger the jurisdiction, the better off you are. And part of the reason is that people don't have as many alternatives to go to, right? The bigger the jurisdiction, it's like there's more people that you're spreading it, the given loss around, so that gives you a bigger leeway to print more without having the thing fall in value. But also, the bigger it is, sort of, the more they're willing to put up with. Just like right now, the reason the dollar is still so dominant is because the whole world is using it. It's going to take a lot to dislodge the dollar, but that's where we're going with this conversation, is that's precisely what might be behind what they're doing. So to get, I mean, Americans are very jingoist, if you will, and there's no way under normal circumstances Americans are going to turn in their dollar bills and accept something called the Amero that is held by Mexicans and Canadians, because Americans are too proud and, you know, they would revolt against something like that. They would start flipping cars and setting them on fire before they did that. But they might do it if the dollar crashes 20% in a day. And if the stock market crashes and inflation goes up to 25% and that kind of stuff, and then Obama gets on national TV with Ben Bernanke there at a press conference and says, because of this emergency situation, we're going to substitute the currencies out, and I've talked with the other G7 leaders and da-da-da-da, and the Prime Minister of Canada, and we're all in agreement that this will contain the problem. And, you know, you'll be able to go, and so, you know, right now your dollars are useless. The stuff that's in your dollar, in your wallet right now, won't buy anything at the store. That, you know, a can of tuna fish costs $20 right now. If you turn your dollars in and take these Omeros, or whatever, they probably might call it something else, then, you know, look at what these things will trade for and buy you in the store. So that's the way they might get people to do it. And then once they switch over the currencies, well, there's no going back. All right. So anyway, yes, it is a conspiracy theory, but it's pretty plausible, I think. And the one virtue of it is that it explains what Bernanke has been doing. Because whether you're a Keynesian, a quasi-monetarist, or an Austrian, what Bernanke has been doing doesn't make any sense. It's not the right thing to do, right? So what if you're of those three different schools, you might think he should be doing different things. It's not that we're all in agreement on what he ought to be doing, but the point is, what he has been doing is not... So every school of thought is upset at Bernanke. The Austrians think he's doing too much. The quasi-monetarists and the Keynesians think he's doing too little. And so, you know, you could say, well, he's just trying to keep everybody happy. Or you could say, no, what he's doing is actually not because of some prediction pumped out by his model, but is in fact that he's trying to set things up so that when the time is right, the dollar crashes, and then they can switch the currencies out. So obviously, I'm not saying that is what's going on, but I'm just saying that's not obviously a crazy idea. That could be what's going on. And we do know historically, I mean, there have been regions that have gone to a common currency, so it's not like that's impossible. So what's interesting, this is my prediction, if that were to happen, and all the people right now who are saying, oh, you guys are a bunch of black helicopter nut jobs, there's no plan in place, I guarantee you this would happen. If 20 years from now, the U.S. dollar is no longer in existence, and where Americans are using some other currency that's a regional one, the people right now making fun of the conspiracy theorists, they're not going to say, oh my gosh, you guys were right. They're going to say, well, it wasn't a conspiracy. They had to do that because did you see the dollar collapsed 20% in a day? And the, you know, the stock market crashed 40% and inflation was running at 40% annually. So duh, of course they switched the thing. What are you saying? They should have just sat around and done nothing while people couldn't buy food? That's what they're going to do. So don't ever think you're going to be vindicated. No matter what, the people who make fun of conspiracy theories right now are going to continue to do so. They're never going to say they were wrong, even if the scenarios that the conspiracy theorists are warning about come true perfectly down to the last semicolon of their story. People will just say, well, that's not for the reason you said. It wasn't this grand conspiracy, which is that's what had to happen. All right, so we'll stop there, and we'll have, remember, the last lecture is on Monday, so we'll see you guys then. Check, check, check. What in the world is going on?